Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Pakistan President Asif Ali Zardari says today's bloodshed won't deter the government from its mission of eliminating extremists who, he said, are waging a guerrilla war. Today, teams of gunmen hit three law enforcement facilities in Lahore, and a car bomb devastated a police station in northwest Pakistan. The attacks killed more than three dozen people. More than 100 have been killed in the last 2 weeks. Well, let's start with the latest from Ethirajan Ambarasan. He's the BBC's South Asia editor in London. Ethirajan, we have the standard opening question. Do we know who the attackers are?
So far, no group has said it carried out the attack, but the government normally would blame the Taliban militants, the Tehrik-e-Taliban militant group, which is considered to be an umbrella group of all the Islamist militant groups in the northwestern frontier region of Pakistan. But the Islamist militants do have some of their support groups in the Punjab province as well. So normally the suspicion would fall on the Islamist militants who would have carried out this attack.
Yeah, well, yesterday in the program we spoke about the different types of militants, the homegrown Islamic Taliban, and there are different Taliban, the foreign fighters and Al-Qaeda, and the militants in Pakistan who traditionally fight India with the blessing of some of Pakistan's secret agencies. So this can get complicated. But do you think that these attacks are in direct response to the government saying they are going to go after militants, especially in southern Wajiristan?
Many people would think so, because the government says that it is now gearing up for an offensive against the militants, Al-Qaeda and Taliban militants, in the South Waziristan tribal region, which is far away from where the attacks took place. And the South Waziristan region is a known haven for Al-Qaeda and Taliban militants. The Pakistani Air Force jets have been carrying out raids, attacking militant hideouts in this particular region for months now, and they have been talking about an imminent ground offensive. Of course, this offensive comes months after another military offensive against militant positions in the Swat Valley. But militants, they did warn that if the government goes ahead with this particular offensive, then they will see the repercussions in other parts of Pakistan. And that is what we are seeing it right now. And the government does admit that this could be in response to their stepped-up operations against the militants in the northwestern region, which borders Afghanistan.
How much of this has to do with the conversations happening in Washington, the debate over whether to send more troops to Afghanistan or shift more of the focus to militant groups in Pakistan, and an aid package that comes with strings attached asking the Pakistani government to do more to fight militants? How much do these attacks have to do with that?
What has happened in Washington by sending in more troops to Afghanistan, by stepping up operations against the Taliban militants in Afghanistan? The Taliban militants have come under pressure because of that. And also the drone attacks in the border areas, they come and bomb certain selected targets. And some of the top militant leaders were killed in these attacks. For example, Baitullah Masood, he was the leader of the Taliban movement in the Waziristan region. And it is widely believed that these drone attacks were conducted or managed by the CIA. So this has put a lot of pressure on the militants on the border region. And also, if you see what President Barack Obama has been saying, they want to focus more on Afpak border. On the one side, if the American troops can put pressure on the Taliban on the Afghan side, and they expect the Pakistani forces to launch operations against the Taliban militants on the Pakistani side. In the meanwhile, the drone attacks are continuing, and the American officials have indicated that they will step up these attacks because they have proved successful. Whatever is happening in Washington has a direct impact in the border region between Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Are the Pakistan security forces up for this? Here we have these militants attacking army headquarters, police stations, which are supposed to be heavily fortified. Does this say that the militants are stronger than we think, or that Pakistan security forces are weaker?
What you are seeing is hit and run. This kind of a guerrilla warfare, of course, can create damage, but doesn't mean that Pakistani army or Pakistani security forces can be easily defeated by these militants. And now they are retaliating. They are trying to create a damage, then the Pakistani government's image among the public, cause a panic. And that is what they have been doing.
As sending the message, as Julian Vorger writes on the Guardian website, that no target is beyond their reach. Athirajan Ambarasan, the BBC's South Asia editor, speaking to us from London. Athirajan, thank you.
Thank you.
Did you know that 130 million Americans, 43% of us, are without any kind of dental insurance? That in 2000, there were 224 counties in the U.S. without a single dentist? Did you know that the U.S. is graduating fewer dentists today than it was 20 years ago from fewer dental schools? You may know that in 2007, a 12-year-old boy in Prince George's County, Maryland, died for want of a tooth extraction. His family relied on Medicaid, and in Maryland, less than a fifth of all dentists accept Medicaid patients, in part because they truly can't break even on Medicaid payments. Well, today we want to take a closer look at dental care. It's been overlooked in all the talk of health care reform, but lack of it causes serious problems ranging from heart disease to, as we just heard, death. Slate editor June Thomas has written a 7-part series called The American Way of Dentistry. You can get to it at our website, herenow.org. June, who knew so much could be said about dentists? Welcome.
Thank you so much.
This is a story that's close to your heart. It starts with your own personal observation. You grew up in a part of England that didn't at all value dental care?
Yes, it was very much a specific place, a specific time. I grew up in an area where there was just an expectation that you would have false teeth probably by the time you were around 30.
Oh boy.
I really don't remember seeing any member of my family, certainly, or even anybody in the neighborhood who had their own teeth. And I remember when I first went to a rather fancy secondary school, so I was about 11, I kept seeing these adults, you know, people who were over 35 that had their own natural teeth, and I just was so boggled by this.
There was no dental care, no brushing.
No, I never brushed my teeth, and I did actually go to the dentist. So it wasn't that there was no awareness of the need for oral hygiene generally. As I would go to the dentist, they would pull teeth or just put crowns on. They just really didn't take a lot of effort to preserve the teeth, because even they acknowledged that they would probably be coming out relatively soon. It was just the culture.
Well, then you come to the United States and you find two things. First of all, that there is still a class of people in this country that doesn't have dental care, but for very different reasons. But also that there's another class post the 50s and 60s that thinks the most important thing is to have a gleaming set of white teeth. And you think what when you see that?
Well, it's very intimidating. I mean, I had gradually moved away from my village, and I had an awareness that it really wasn't cool to have a mouthful of rotting teeth. But when I came to the States, I definitely felt that my appearance was a problem. But it was difficult because dental care is expensive. We tend to focus on the cosmetic side of things, but I was having a lot of pain. I couldn't chew very well. Dental pain is one of the most disturbing kinds of pain. It's very difficult to concentrate on anything. For kids in school, it's hard for them to listen to the teacher. It's hard to sleep. It's hard to deal with your kids when you're having dental pain. So I really wanted to take care of that.
Just to you know, for people who say, oh, yeah, I had a toothache once, just try to describe some of the pain that you had.
There's a specific kind of dental pain, I think mostly when you've got an abscess and the root is infected, that you can hear. You kind of have to stop what you're doing and just let it pass because you really can't move. The sound in your head is kind of takes over your world. Mm. And it's just very difficult to do anything when you're suffering with that.
Well, you finally begin to work for Microsoft, other companies.
Yes.
You have dental insurance plans, supplementary plans, and still, you spent how much of your own money over how many years to fix your teeth?
I would say that I spent about $45,000 of my own money over a period of about 10 years.
And was it for this aesthetic that you discovered in the U.S.? And you actually take us through. You say if any movie maker ever wants to label somebody a hick, they give them bad teeth. I mean, we have a way in America of making bad teeth stand for something. So was it that and the idea that you wanted to be social and advance in your career? Or was it for health reasons or was it both?
It was both. I mean, certainly I wanted to be done with that pain. I wanted to be able to chew better. It's much easier to eat vegetables. It's much easier when you don't have a whole range of foods that you just can't eat.
In fact, you've had health people back this up, that one of the problems of bad teeth is that people increasingly eat bad food.
Right. They eat a lot of processed food. They eat a lot of, you know, canned foods that are easier to chew, but that are not particularly nutritious. To be out of pain, to be able to chew, is fantastic. And also not feeling that you look different and that you immediately set yourself as a different kind of person from the people that you want to mix with at work or that you're expected to mix with. It makes a huge difference to your attitude to life and to your comfort level.
Get us deeper into the crisis in dentistry. And what is peculiar about the way most dentists practice that make it very hard for them to cover, let's say, Medicaid patients? Take us through some of the issues.
Well, the big difference in dentistry is that almost all, about 80 to 85% of dentists, are basically small business people. They pay all the bills, and that includes electricity, the cost of the office, the rent of the office, the staff, which can be extensive. They need people to process insurance claims, to call people about their appointments, to assist them at the chairs. So they have a lot of expenses.
And that's also why there's a crisis in rural and poor areas, because it's very hard for dentists to rationalize setting up shop in, let's say, a very poor area where a lot of people might be on Medicaid, which is just a very low payment, or rural areas where there's just not going to be enough patients to justify the expense that a dentist have in setting up shop.
Exactly. Medicaid reimbursements, for example, are often said to be below their costs of operating. In most places, in fact, that's the case. So even those people who would really like to help low-income patients find that it costs them money, in effect. Another factor is that if you bring a different kind of person into the waiting room, generally speaking, a lower income person, the full fee patients tend to become a little bit uncomfortable, and so their income really can suffer. In rural areas, there just aren't enough patients who can cover the costs, and so there's very little incentive for them to set up a practice in that area.
Well, and the dental safety net is the 58 schools across the country that have clinics, have teaching clinics, but you say those are cutting back.
Yeah, there have been a couple of schools that have opened recently, but the overall trend has been for dental schools to close. Dental schools face expenses that medical schools don't have. In the first couple of years, dental students, like medical students, learn about anatomy and all those things. In fact, a lot of the classes sometimes are shared. But in the third and fourth years, where they're doing their practical education, the clinical education, doctors go off to teaching hospitals. But dental students work in clinics that the dental schools have to pay for, and they're extremely expensive. And because of this high overhead, several prestigious schools, places like Georgetown, Northwestern, Emory, have closed their dental schools. Mm-hmm. And so we're graduating a lot fewer dentists these days than in the 80s, even though the population of the country is now one-third more, and what's more, we're keeping our teeth for much longer.
Right. You say we have less dentists and more teeth. In fact, the baby boomers are going to be the first generation to enter retirement with nearly all their teeth.
Yes.
That's Slate editor June Thomas, who also says one of the reasons the cost of dental care is going up is because there are fewer dentists and more teeth. When we come back, some imaginative ways to get more dental care to people who don't have it now. And later today, how do you grow crops like beans and corn in the desert of northeastern Arizona without irrigation? A Hopi Indian family is doing just that, as we'll see. Back in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're hearing about the crisis in dental health with Slate editor June Thomas. June says, if you have no money and your appendix bursts, a hospital emergency room can help you. But if you have a serious tooth infection, most emergency rooms aren't equipped to deal with that. So there's no safety net. And people with bad teeth can't eat healthy food. Dental bacteria has been linked to cardiovascular disease, diabetes, pneumonia, premature births. And then there's dental insurance. June Thomas found that even many dentists think of it as more of a prepayment plan, kind of like car payments, because unlike other health insurance, you usually pay much more out of pocket for dentistry as the procedure gets more involved. And June, you say this is part of a deeper problem with dental insurance.
The fact that we think of it as insurance is really kind of a problem because, you know, we say, well, I don't have insurance, I'm not going to go to the dentist. Problems get worse the longer you wait. And also, if you don't have your teeth cleaned, there's more chance of a problem arising and getting worse. So I think really it would help us all if we just figured that dentistry is something that we need to start saving for because we're going to have to pay for it one way or another.
While we wait for some kind of reform, by the way, do you think that that's possible? Do you think, given that there's such debate about paying for medical care, that do you think dental care is going to be on the back burner a lot longer?
I hope that there will be some help for children. Most children across the U.S. are covered for dental services under Medicaid. If there was more funding so that the fees were higher, I think children could really get a lot more dental care. I do fear that there's not going to be anything for adults in this first round of health care reform.
Well, so what to do in the meantime? You talk about, for instance, clinics. Some of them have federal subsidies. Mm-hmm. Isn't that a good idea? Because you spoke to dentists who were happy, in fact, to give up the burden of having their own practices with all the costs and just go work at a clinic.
Absolutely. It's a very attractive option for a lot of dentists who don't want the headache of being owner-operators, who also don't want the debt of buying a business. The average education debt for dental school graduates is just a hair under $170,000. And so working in a clinic can be an attractive option. And it's also a great way for people to get care. People without insurance or people with Medicaid often feel more comfortable in a clinic that was in their neighborhood, where they could travel to on the bus, where they just felt more at ease.
Well, you mentioned travel on the bus. The American Dental Association, you write, doesn't believe there's a shortage of dentists as much as that idea of the geographic imbalance. And they suggest things like finding a bus, a way to help patients travel to counties with dentists, or subsidize a plan to have traveling dentists.
Yeah, or to basically subsidize dentists to set up practices in rural areas or in underserved areas. So dental schools, federally qualified health clinics, which is a fancy word for kind of neighborhood clinics that provide services, often both medical and dental in the same building, sometimes also social workers, mental health provision. I think those are great options, but right now they are severely underfunded.
Well, and you also talk about other thinking of taking more advantage of dental students. The Washington State Dental Association has the program, the Rural Internship in Private Practice. What does that do?
Yeah, that allows dental students who've completed their first year of dental school and so who can essentially work as assistants to dentists in rural areas. And they learn what small town life is like. Most dental school graduates are not from the country. And there is a sense of isolation when they think about going out to these rural areas.
Well, other places have required students to spend some time in rural areas. You write about Delaware, New York.
In most places in the U.S., a dental school graduate can immediately go into practice. But in New York and Delaware, they have to serve a fifth-year residency. And there has been some movement to make this compulsory around the country, in fact, encouraging or making it compulsory, perhaps, for those fifth-year residents to practice in an underserved area.
And some people are saying, well, let's go further. Let's say if you do that across the country, we'll somehow tie that to paying off student loans.
That's a great incentive to get new graduates practicing in areas that really need help.
And Arizona, I just want to note this, the Arizona School of Dentistry and Oral Health at A.T. Still University, you write it just enrolled its first class in 2003, is going even further. They're teaching a community-based education model to try to turn out students who will want to go to underserved communities.
Exactly. Community dentistry and public health dentistry is absolutely their whole focus.
What about the move, which seems a little more controversial, to make dental hygienists and assistants able to do more dental duties?
Yeah, this is a very controversial notion, but one that I think holds a lot of promise for solving the shortage of dentists. I should say, first of all, that the ADA, the American Dental Association, denies that there is a shortage, but people who just can't see a dentist would disagree with that. So in Alaska, for example, there's been this movement to set up a new kind of role, a dental health aid therapist, usually called a DHAT. And these are people who are not dentists, but they are usually hygienists who get extra training and are allowed to do certain basic dental procedures, fillings, extractions, without the direct supervision of a dentist. This is quite common around the world. The first Alaska students actually studied in New Zealand, which has been a pioneer of this role. Now, the ADA doesn't like it. They believe that everybody should be able to see a dentist, which is very difficult to argue with, but I think a dental health therapist is certainly more attractive than not being able to see a dentist at all.
Well, as you write, we go back to a little 12-year-old Diamante driver who died for lack of care, and it was for lack of an $80 tooth extraction.
That's right, because Diamante's mother couldn't get an appointment with a dentist for him. The state of Maryland ended up paying $250,000 for his care, and unfortunately, on top of that, he died.
For lack of an $80 procedure.
Exactly.
Slate editor June Thomas. You can read her 7-part series, The American Way of Dentistry, by going to our website, hereandnow.org. June, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Okay, looking ahead tomorrow on Here and Now, his most famous book is about to hit the theaters. We'll speak with author Maurice Sendak about his life, his art, and where are those wild things anyway? That's tomorrow. The latest news is next, Here and Now. Wednesday was a good day for Wall Street. The Dow Jones crested past the 10,000 mark, up 53% from its March low. Traders popped champagne corks. They handed out baseball caps that said 10,000. But market analysts say large pension and hedge funds are behind the rally, and some are warning the rebound is too fast and doesn't yet include the small investor, ordinary Americans who saw the retirement accounts fall off the cliff over the past year. Jeff Cosnett is senior editor of Kiplinger's Personal Finance. Jeff, what do you think is behind this rally?
It's professional investors, large pools of money that have decided that it's better to take a little more risk in the stock market and in other markets, you know, bond markets, commodities, whatnot too, rather than leave money in the bank or in short-term cash accounts that are basically paying no interest whatsoever.
Well, but we know a big criticism of the current economy is that there isn't enough money getting out to small businesses. There's a lot of money, a lot of government money, in fact, but it's being bundled and sold and sometimes in the form of mortgages on Wall Street. So it's staying on Wall Street. So do you think this 10,000 mark really is an indicator of a healthier economy?
Not totally, not in that part of it. Credit is still tight. Banks have been forced to tighten their credit standards, and for every bank that catches some kind of opprobrium because they have cut back on credit card balances or raised interest rates or been slower to make car loans and mortgages, well, you know, they're doing the same thing to business clients, and not just small business clients, big business clients. As a result, many of them have stopped borrowing money from banks and have floated bonds, and all that feeds into the fact that there's a big hunger for securities that are returning more than bank accounts and cash do, and that includes both stocks and bonds.
Well, in fact, we read that small investors have pulled billions of dollars out of stocks and put them into bonds. What have you seen people do?
Well, I think you're right, and every month the mutual fund industry publishes the amount of money that is coming into and leaving mutual funds, which, as you know, are what most people invest in through their IRAs and 401ks. So it's a pretty good read on you and me and every family in America and what they're doing with their long-term savings and investments. And they are inhaling money into bond funds and even into money market funds. People are buying just about anything that is seen to be safe, even though a smart investor or an experienced one knows that when stocks are cheap and interest rates are low, stocks are often safer than bonds. And I think right now that's what we've seen. Now, this may be changing just as the, quote, little guy, and by the little guy, I don't know how little you mean, because, you know, there are many people that have $500,000 in retirement funds. Maybe they used to have $1 million, but, I mean, they have a lot of money. Problem is that many of them might be tempted to overdo the stock market now because of events like yesterday, when they should have been in it all along, or they should have been gradually feeding money back into it over the last 6 months to a year.
So let's get some advice from you. What do you think the small investor should do now? Some are saying that 10,000 mark yesterday may have broken a psychological barrier, but do you think it's wise to jump back in?
Well, it's not really wise to jump, but it's certainly wise to move and slide. Now, one of the things about the way that people invest money these days, and this has been going on ever since the 401ks and the IRAs came about, is most people I know invest money regularly, $100 a month here, $300 a month there. So I don't think there was too much jumping in and out. And there shouldn't be on the way in as opposed to the way out. I would spread the money around a little bit wider. If you have a menu of mutual funds that includes some real estate funds or some foreign stock funds or something like that, throw a little money that way. But don't. There are two things not to do. One is don't just take every dime you've got now and just go gaga, because this market rally has really gone a long way in a very quick time. And two, the next time you see headlines that say, you know, the stocks have a bad day, that this Dow goes from 10,000 down to 9,200 or something like that, unless there's some particular reason why you need to do this, you know, don't take your money out. Put in a little more.
Jeff Kosnitz, senior editor of Kiplinger's Personal Finance. Jeff, thanks so much.
Sure.
Okay, quick reminder, you can always listen to our program stream live at our website, hereandnow.org, where you can also download a podcast. Take us with you wherever you go, hereandnow.org. We'll be back in 30 seconds when we're going to go to a Hopi reservation in Arizona to continue our farm series, Here and Now. Welcome back to our series, Five Farms, Profiles of Farm Families Across the Country, which takes us today to the Hopi Reservation in the high desert of northeastern Arizona and the Pacuza family. Davis Pacuza, his wife Alma, and their son David raise corn and beans on 20 acres, much the way their ancestors did a millennium ago. They practice dry farming, growing crops without irrigation. Our story was produced by John Bewin and Camille Lapaca.
Farming is... With us, Hopis is number one. My English name is Davis Fred Pekusa is my last name. There's a clan, Pekuskian. They're primarily from Shungopa, the Second Mesa area. Apparently my grandfather's father was from that area. Of course, they're originally from Uluribi. This whole area is surrounded by mesas. This whole area is Hopi land. Nothing like home. No place like home. This is where I'll be laid to rest.
I think it's really important to him because when he talks of this place, he really gets that heartfelt feeling. My name's David Pekuza. He doesn't want this to be let go and turn back into bushes. And, you know, he wants someone to keep doing it and keep it going.
Well, I think that maybe David will be the only one that will take it over. He's the only one that's left with us here, and he's going out there, and his father gave him a piece of land. We have two other boys who are gone, and I doubt if they'll ever come back.
My two brothers, they live in Phoenix now, and you know, they got their careers and their families, and one thing is we're half Hopi and half Pima, and we were teased a lot, and that feeling that we're not really a part of something, yeah, trying to belong or something. So I think they still carry that with them.
Well, I have a boy, John. He's in accounting with the Salt River Tribe. He's pretty much like his dad, a workaholic. And same with my other boy, being a dental technician. I usually don't tell my kids, you know, stay home, do this. You know, I just let them do their own thing as long as they're responsible people. So I'm happy with their choices, what they're doing now.
We love mutton. We like mutton in this house. For the past 10 years, that has been my way of making money, is being a cook. It's my career, working in kitchens. And I was in Phoenix for like maybe about 5 years. And then I didn't feel right in Phoenix for some reason. And I wanted to come home. And we've always done farming ever since I could remember. So I really dove into farming and truly trying to understand, you know, what it is to take care of it every day and things like that. And a lot of things that I didn't think I paid attention to growing up, it was already embedded in me without me really knowing. And I really needed to recall these things, these teachings. That's when it started coming back. And that's when I start really finding out that, you know, that I did have that information in me and I could do these things.
But there's not very many boys that are willing to go out and do it now.
I don't think it's going to really totally go away. It's just a part of a way of life. I think it'll just become more scarce. But there will always be a core.
That's been my whole life, is just to understand my concept as my place here, you know, as not as someone that's not a full Hopi, and trying to understand the religion and how it goes with the lifestyle, and really trying to make sense out of the whole thing. That's the reason why I'm born here and doing these things. And but the farming has really put it in place for me.
All right, you guys aren't even through yet. I'm going to put the blue corn there. You said you wanted that blue corn there? Or just all white?
All white, and then you're going to do blue at that little strip.
Yeah, I think we'll put blue there.
Then the other...
White
over there. Okay.
Davis, David, and Alma Bakuza, who farm on the Hopi Reservation in northeastern Arizona. Our series, Five Farms, is a production of Wesley Horner Productions and the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke University. Well, we have a little time for your calls and letters. Celine Grenier of Capitola, California, wrote after our explainer on the plan to securitize life insurance policies. Now, people have long sold their policies to make quick cash, but now Wall Street is hoping to bundle and trade them because the younger policyholders are when they die, the more money traders make. Well, Celine writes, that should work out great. These same Wall Street types will assure we don't get health care. More of us will die early, and these new instruments will prove to be worth their AAA ratings. Awesome. Well, many of you were touched by our conversation with Margaret Moth, the legendary camerawoman who's faced wars and is now battling cancer. Wendy McKee, a 21-year-old college student in North Carolina, writes, I was making lunch with Here and Now in the background. It's been a really long time since I felt as inspired and driven as I was listening to her story. It made me feel brave. Thank you. Emma Garcia of Las Vegas, Nevada, wrote after our report on the four New Hampshire teens who allegedly went on a murderous rampage. Emma took issue with my describing them as children. She writes, they knew exactly what they were doing and should be held responsible if found guilty. There isn't anything in their actions to associate them with the word children. And Sue Broder wrote, after a conversation with Lucy Ferris, who'd come to an uneasy truce with her son's gambling, Sue writes, isn't it illegal to gamble under the age of 21? Are the online gambling rules different? Well, the legal age for gambling varies. In some states, it's as young as 16, but in Nevada, it's 21. As for gambling online, Lucy says, if you can't do it in a casino in your location, you can't do it online. Finally, we recently featured the guitar sounds of Rodrigo and Gabriela, whose new album is called 1111, referring to the 11 artists they pay homage to. But we wondered, why was there online chatter about people who see 1111 on the clock and take time to make a wish? Well, Ephraim Shapiro from Sharon, Massachusetts, had the answer.
Because all those ones look like birthday candles. Nothing really creepy or eerie. It's just, make a wish.
Oh. We'd love to hear from you. Just go to hereandnow.org and click on Contact Us. Back in 1 minute, Here and Now. It's an unlikely friendship, an off-white stray dog, and an 8,700-pound Asian elephant. And that's Tara, the elephant, talking to her friend, Bella the dog. They met at the Elephant Sanctuary in Tennessee, and life was grand. Then Bella the dog got hurt, and Tara the elephant stood rooted to one spot, waiting to hear, would she be okay? But I'm getting ahead of myself. The story of their loyalty is already a YouTube sensation, and now Carol Buckley, co-founder, president, and executive director of the Elephant Sanctuary in Hohenwald, Tennessee, tells it again in the new children's book, Tara and Bella, the elephant and dog who became best friends. And Carol joins us from the sanctuary. Carol, I just want to ask first about the sound we just heard from Tara the elephant. It sounds like she's barking like a dog. Do all elephants talk like that?
Well, all elephants speak, but I've never heard another elephant that sounds so much like a barking dog.
Well, perhaps this explains a lot. I mean, no wonder Bella was attracted. She probably just thinks this is odd, doesn't look like a dog, but...
Sounds like a dog.
Sounds like a dog. Tell us a little bit about the background here, the sanctuary. When did it start, and what was Tara's role there?
Well, the sanctuary started in 1995, and Tara is the reason the sanctuary exists. I met Tara when she was a one-year-old baby, newly captured and brought in from Southeast Asia, and she was living in California in the back of a delivery truck on exhibit at a tire store.
Well, now, between your meeting her in the back of that truck, which sounds awful, at a tire store, and the sanctuary, she was an entertainer. She was in the movie Annie and appeared on television. She was in Little House on the Prairie. Was this while she was in your care? Because we know now you're very much against animals as entertainers.
She was in my care all that time. We were partners. And it was as a result of performing in circuses that taught me over time that this was not what was best for Tara, for any elephant living in captivity.
Well, and tell us more about that. What did you see that told you it wasn't good for her?
These animals are migratory, naturally. They walk, you know, 30 to 50 miles every day, and she didn't have access to a vast space to just wander. And then, of course, I was not meeting her needs by keeping her separated from other elephants. She was not allowed to develop the close social bonds that elephants do.
So you start the sanctuary, and she's the first elephant there. Slowly, other elephants come from circuses that no longer need them. And you start to see something happen. You talk about these animals being so social, and you start to see them pair off. But Tara doesn't pair off.
Yes, interestingly enough, she is very comfortable around other elephants. She interacts with them, touches, naps with them. But what I noticed was that she didn't attach herself to just one other elephant.
No, instead, she attached herself to one dog named Bella. Bella was a stray?
Bella was a stray. Now, it was just probably 2 or 3 months after she arrived that one day I'm looking through our observation cameras in the habitat and I see Tara lying on her side sleeping, and I saw Bella, and Bella walked over close to Tara, circled 2 or 3 times in the tall grass, and then she just plopped herself down and went to sleep right next to Tara.
The beginning of a beautiful friendship, because they became inseparable, doing everything together. Bella will bark excitedly, and then Tara will gently brush her trunk across Bella's side to make sure her best friend was okay. I'm reading from your book. Then Tara would chatter and trumpet in response, so they seem to talk to each other. But one day, you can't find Bella the dog. You see Tara standing in one place. What did you discover?
We, you know, sort of scanned the area, drove around, see if we could find Bella, and didn't see her. And the reason that we couldn't see her is that she was in a depression in the ground, and there was a log in front.
You find Bella, you realize she's had a severe, is it a spinal cord injury? And she's carried up to the sanctuary barn to recuperate. And then is it true that Tara remained standing, staring at the path that you drove away with Bella, just stood there?
She stayed in the exact location where Bella had been found. 2 days was apparently her limit, and then she came back to the barn to see what had happened with Bella.
Well, and here, I mean, this is the scene that's on YouTube, and of course it's in the book as well. She's outside the recovery room, and Bella senses she's there. Bella's very injured, can't go out, but Bella starts whining and squirming, and Tara outside starts chattering and bellowing. I mean, they wanted to see each other.
Absolutely. It was unmistakable. And so, of course, right away, one of the caregivers went up and said, oh, well, we have to pick Bella up and take her down to see Tara. And she stood there and let Tara touch all over her.
With her trunk.
And this is what elephants do with each other to make sure that everything's okay. They're very tactile, and they use their trunk just to sense and make sure that everything's fine.
Well, the end of the story is that Bella did recover. She limps a little bit, but they now still nap together and play together. But I had one question for you. Are you at all concerned? Because we wondered, how did she get injured in the first place? There are these extraordinary pictures of Tara the elephant lifting her giant tree trunk foot over Bella while she's on the ground and keeping it safely above her. But we wondered, do you worry that that maybe is how the dog was injured, and should they be together?
Well, you know, it's an important question to ask, and that's the first thing that we wanted to know. And when the veterinarian examined Bella and x-rayed her, the first thing he told us is that there was no blunt force trauma. And he said, that means that she wasn't stepped on, hit, thrown. And I said, well, then how could she have sustained this injury to her spine? And he said, twisting, most likely while she was running or maybe jumping. So then we went back to the location where we found Bella, and what we saw was a huge fallen tree, and then beyond that tree, a depression in the ground covered by tall grass. So if Bella was chasing something and she went to jump over that log and then found herself in midair with no ground underneath her, she could have twisted that way and caused that injury.
Well, Carol Buckley, of course, Hollywood came calling. This was such an incredible story. And you could have gotten a lot of money to let Hollywood make a film, maybe even with Tara and Bella. But you turned it down. Why?
What we said is create an animated piece. And then you don't have to hire elephants, even if it's not Tara and Bella. The lifestyle that an elephant has to live to do studio work is a lifestyle that is not, really can't be considered healthy for elephants. And if we bring them into captivity, they should be given an environment where they can live out their natural behaviors with other elephants, and that we benefit by knowing that we've given them a good life.
Carol, thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate it.